This podcast is a part of the Neuhoff Media Podcast Network.
We begin the hour with City Council candidate Jacob Jenkins. Jacob, good to have you back with us. Thank you for being here today. I got to tell you, I feel sorry for all of you guys and ladies that are running for office. This has been a tough year with the pandemic. What's the biggest difference in your mind between last time you ran for office and this time with all the restrictions that COVID has caused?
Well, this is what I'll say, Brian. First of all, thank you for inviting me or extending an invitation to come in, share my thoughts and views on the show with your listening audience on today. And I would say that one of the most challenging things that we've faced is not being able to assemble. That in and of itself has made things extremely difficult when it comes to whether it's knocking on doors or whether it's trying to host any type of meeting to where, or campaign event even, to where, you know, you can socially distance safe and there's not that fear and everything else. So I would say those are some of the things that have been really challenging, is just really being able to be together or try to get large audiences to where you can get this message out.
Yeah, I feel for you. I really do. It is tough. All right, let's talk about your platform. How do we grow civic engagement? You know, we all are disappointed in the low voter turnout. We saw that in the primary. I'm not expecting a whole lot of difference in the general election once everything's counted by next Tuesday. But how do we grow that civic engagement?
Well, the thing about it, and I think what has to happen is there has to be a better buy-in from the community. It can't be simply, if my issue isn't being discussed, then I don't want to be a part of the conversation. The other thing is I think that the media can do a better job of really kind of talking about and explaining what the voting process is like. As a historian, an African-American historian, who has both a bachelor's and master's, I can tell you that this comes down to a basic civics lesson. You know, we talk a lot about national and federal elections, but we don't really, at a local level, explain how municipal governments work. And in doing that, we actually do a disservice to our citizens. So there isn't a buy-in at all when it comes to civic engagement or, really civic engagement.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything you just said. All right. Having said that, we will have the votes counted on Tuesday. There's going to be a new representative no matter what happens, because there are two incumbents running and one that is not. So we will definitely see change on the council. Talk to me a little bit about your priorities, and particularly when it comes to reimagining community policing.
Yeah, so first and foremost, I'm a union leader, right? So I represent over 300 union families. I've, you know, successfully negotiated a state contract for over 30,000 state employees. I'm also a part of Decatur Trades and Labor. So I'm really big on this idea of, you know, the right to collective bargaining. However, I think that when we're looking at police and fire safety who have those same rights and that ability to negotiate in their best interest, but they also fall under the umbrella of needing the accountability factor. And so how do we talk about that accountability factor and what should that look like? And I believe that's relationship-based community policing. I believe that, you know, adhering to the residency requirement, as well as I think that we have to encourage specialized training to where they can adequately respond to volatile situations within the urban core. And the other part of it is that we can't expect law enforcement to be mental health providers. You know, we can't expect them to be pastors. We can't expect them to be teachers. We've taken this blanket approach with law enforcement, and it's really exhaustive to them and to their mental health.
All right. One of the other areas that that you sent to us in your platform that I completely agree with is administrative court. And we've had these in-depth conversations about this over the last number of years. The exorbitant fines to many people who are not able to afford those fines, even in a year of COVID where we were struggling to enforce just basic mask wearing and social distancing, many residents in this community were getting hit with fines for weeds.
I'm one of them, Brian. I kid you not. On July the 29th, I had COVID, and they went out and said, I didn't cut my grass. And it was over a $300 fine and fee once they put the $150 court cost together. Once they say that they've cut your lot, that's almost $300. I'm like, this is nuts. In the middle of a pandemic, when the governor had issued a moratorium on making sure that people can't be evicted because people were losing their jobs, the administrative court was still doing fines, fees, and punitive damage. And for me, that's something that's completely heartless when it comes to the city. I am completely in favor of disbanding this administrative court, and it is no secret about it. I've been a staunch opponent of this because I've had firsthand dealings with it, with absorbent numbers of fines and fees. You know, so it's something that I'm not in favor of. I understand its purpose. However, when I got with the Herald and Review and I say, if you put up a heat map of where these fines and fees are being targeted, you'll see patterns. So there's only an exorbitant number of fees in the urban core with poor black and white people who typically already are struggling to pay rent and meet their basic needs. And now you're charging them $300. And I've heard of an instance even where someone was arrested for this.
Yeah, it doesn't stack up when we can't even enforce basic safety rules for people in a 100-year pandemic. Talk to me about homelessness. You have some interesting ideas. You've looked at other communities. It's a tough problem to solve, but what are your thoughts on what we can do for the folks among us who are at their most desperate place in life and the most vulnerable in a community?
Well, the thing about it is, because I am an advocate for mental health, I think that we have to do a much better job of assessing those that need those services. But the other thing, Brian, what we have to do is we have to remove the stigma. You know, just saying that someone is homeless, you know, also carries like a negative weight with it. So I try to use the word unhoused population. We know that on average we have about 130 that are here. You know, and with those are folks that are either underhoused, dealing with mental health issues, dealing with substance abuse issues, or dealing with family issues, or can't get housing because of past criminal records. And then we also have another group of unhoused youth that literally jump from couch to couch. But in dealing with this population, what I found out was that they do work. The majority of them do have some type of income. But the thing about it is, they just can't afford the first month rent of $600, the down payment or the security deposit of another $600, the light bill or the deposit for the light bill. So they don't have that $1,200 that's ready to go. So I'm in favor, literally, of tiny houses, especially for our military vets. I've been studying other cities that have done it well, and I think that that's a real opportunity and some low-hanging fruit for the council to be able to clean that up. And the other thing is it makes our city look more attractive when other people come through town and maybe looking to start businesses or, you know, or bring their families here. You know, no one wants to bring their family to a city to when you're driving down the main street, everyone has a sign asking for money.
Let's talk a little bit about job creation and expanding opportunities for people. Right now in Macon County, there are 1,100 jobs available right now. Yet we have so many people who are underemployed or unemployed. There are efforts that are being made that are working, but how do we continue to connect those dots to get people to those jobs?
Brian, when you look at those numbers, and what you'll see is that a lot of those aren't high-paying jobs. You know, a lot of those jobs are in service industry. They're in fast food, or they're in other places like that. So it's like we're not talking really about living wages when we're looking at those jobs. And the other part of it is, the other end of that spectrum is those are high-earning jobs. So we've got a population, you know, that kind of fall like right in the middle, that have some skill set, you know, that has some trade or whatever else. But, you know, they're over advanced when it comes to the McDonald's work, but they aren't skilled enough to get those, what we would call those luxury jobs at Caterpillar and ADM or in other processing and manufacturing facilities. So we have to take this homegrown approach to where we can do a better job with our schools, with training programs, to make sure that that we are ready not only for the jobs of today, but ready for the jobs of tomorrow. So how do we do that? We focus. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say to you, Jacob, there are programs, Workforce Investment Solutions, and we just interviewed a young woman, the video is on Natticator.com, that moved out of retail and the insecurity that was there to a materials handling position at Caterpillar with the help of these programs that are out there. So some of those jobs, you're right, are lower paying jobs, but Caterpillar right now is looking to hire people. And I think part of the problem is people don't realize they have some of those transferable skills, or with a little bit of help and a little bit of guidance and a pathway, they can get to that point.
No, and I definitely agree with you. But when you have programs like Workforce Investment Solutions, they have a certain number of slots that are available, you know. And so it really comes down to how do we get that information to communities and people who are most in need of those services. You know, so for me, it comes down to a basic level of a marketing campaign. How are you marketing the resources that are available in this community? And we know that because people are in all different types of places, you have to have a multi-level marketing strategy to where you can hit them from different levels. That's how we begin to do that.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about cannabis. I know you're a proponent. My concerns about it are much the same as I have about the gambling facilities in this community. Mm-hmm. A lot of that money is being sucked right out of our community and going to some corporation somewhere else, you know. And I worry about the same thing. I'm looking at what's happened in Illinois and this whole application process. It doesn't seem like to me that it was as promised. And why are you in favor of it? Why do you think it's a good thing?
So I'm in favor of cannabis because it made over $1 billion in tax revenue for the state of Illinois. And with that, communities that that had like their dispensaries and things like that, they've been able to invest in roads. They've been able to invest in schools, and they've been available to invest back into their community. So we missed out. The city of Decatur missed out even on the reentry funding that was tied to cannabis, because we want nothing to deal with cannabis here in this community. So I'm not just a proponent for dispensaries. This is an agricultural hub. I am in favor of testing it in our facilities. I am in favor of testing it in our labs. I'm in favor of the statewide distribution of it with our trucking and our logistics. We have the framework in place with having the inland port and everything else to get things across the state of Illinois very fast. So why wouldn't we take advantage of an agricultural crop? I call Decatur Little Vegas because when you go to any corner, you see all of these gambling machines. And these are restaurants and these are places that have not even met the threshold for having 50% of sales of food and liquor. So I'm saying we're really not really ambiguous on this. I think that we've missed the mark on this. And I don't want this to be a situation to where the city of Decatur is hurt, like with the mall that went out more so towards Forsyth. I think this is an opportunity for us to meet our fire and police pension, as well as to invest in homelessness, as well as to make our city better and make it a more competitive city with the other cities that are around us, like Springfield, like Bloomington, like Champaign. We can't continue to lose residents and annex people. We have to have a better plan for that. And we can't continue to rely on the benevolence of a wonderful foundation, which is the Buffett Foundation, which has done some wonderful things, but that cannot be the city's bread and butter.
All right, Jacob, how do people get a hold of you in these last few days before the election if they want to support your campaign financially, yard signs, whatever it might be? What's the best way for people to contact you?
If they would like to contact us, they can simply go on Facebook to Jacob Jenkins for City Council. And we also have a website where a lot of this information is available, and it's www.voteforjacob.com.
I would also like to point out you were endorsed by AFSCME Council 31, Decatur Trades and Labor, and you got the Herald and Review endorsement as well this time around.
Yes, I did, Brian Byers. And again, I want to thank you today for having this wonderful, cordial conversation, allowing me to get out some of the main points of this. I want to encourage your listeners that this is an opportunity to possibly get something new on the city council and have a more equitable city. So thank you again, Mr. Byers.
All right, Jacob, good luck to you on Tuesday. Jacob Jenkins, our final council candidate interview.
You've been listening to the Newhoff Media Podcast Network. For more, visit newhoffmedia.com.